Hello, welcome to Network Europe. It's the holiday season. We find out where Europeans go and how they behave when they get there in this specially themed programme on the subject of being abroad. We go to Bulgaria and the return of the condemned medics who probably wish they'd never gone abroad in the first place. Plus, are young Swedes Europe's most dedicated holiday boozers?
Younger people maybe, yes. That's maybe true.
Also coming up are British men, Europe's most dedicated holiday boozers.
I met members of stag parties on a night out in Krakow, having it large in the vernacular of the visitors. None of the interviews could be used in this report.
And to avoid a sub-theme developing, we ask if Norwegians are Europe's most pampered people, now that the government sends the sick and elderly on free holidays to Spain. Plus our weekly postcard this week from Atlantis, or Britain as it used to be known.
The next days, or holidays as they should have been, were spent emptying and cleaning a brand new apartment of everything inside it. Black, stinking crud had permeated everything.
And I'll be announcing the winners of this month's quiz. All this and a bit more coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters. This week coming to you from Hilversum in Holland, with me, Richard Walker. Now, before we get into the holiday mood, Europe's biggest story this week was the return home of a group of Bulgarians who moved abroad in the 1990s, only to find themselves facing a death sentence for crimes they didn't commit. The six Bulgarian medics repatriated by Libya on Tuesday captured headlines across the continent. They'd been jailed for deliberately infecting children with HIV, but had always protested their innocence. Earlier, I spoke to Network Europe's Radostin Zhelev at Radio Bulgaria's studios in Sofia, and he described the jubilant scenes as the medics touched down at the city's airport.
It was so emotional. I mean, it was the moment that the French governmental airplane had touched ground on, at Sofia airport, and I suggest that I play the coverage of the reporter of Radio Bulgaria.
The French aircraft carrying on board the five innocent Bulgarian nurses has touched down. President Georgi Parvanov, Prime Minister Sergei Stanishev, Foreign Minister Ivan Lvov-Calvin, and the ambassadors of the UK, France and the United States to Bulgaria are on the tarmac to meet them. Loads of flowers and a great deal of hugging and kissing as the medics step onto Bulgarian soil. They're not trying to hide their emotions. They look in good health, they're smiling, they seem happy.
When was the last time you saw scenes like this at Sofia Airport?
I think I've witnessed such scenes on two occasions. The first one was when the Bulgarian football national side won fourth place at the 1994 soccer championships in the United States. And also when we welcomed the athletes from the Sydney Olympics.
Both sporting events,
yes,
I notice.
Exactly.
So there's definitely a sense of national jubilation, of pride, perhaps.
Exactly, yes.
Has this been a long-running story in Bulgaria since the six were convicted in 1999?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's been on the news ever since they were first arrested in 1999 and they were convicted first in 2004. The first death sentences were issued on May the 6th, 2004, and then they were confirmed on December the 19th, 2006 by the Supreme Court. Then there was the appeal, and after the appeal, they were confirmed once more until July the 17th, when the High Judicial Council, this year, 2007, when the High Judicial Council commuted the death sentences to life imprisonment.
So this has been an emotional and sort of an intensely followed story in Bulgaria all the way through.
Exactly, and not only in Bulgaria. So ever since the first issuing of the death sentences in 2004, Bulgaria has tried to involve the international community, particularly so after Bulgaria joined the European Union on January the 1st, 2007. The international outcry has been really, really immense. And France, the United Kingdom and the European Union altogether has been really, really involved with that.
Do you get the feeling that Nicolas Sarkozy, the new French president, was particularly involved in the sort of finalising of this deal to get the medics released? Because he seems to be the face face of the whole campaign, doesn't he? He's the one who's been in Libya also this week after the return of the medics, talking to the Libyan government. Do you get the sense in Bulgaria that it's Nicolas Sarkozy's pet project?
I think to us Bulgarians who have been following the case very closely, things are a bit different. I mean, it's not only down to Nicolas Sarkozy, especially due to the fact that Nicolas Sarkozy only got involved in this process very recently. But definitely it is down to him and his wife, Cecilia Sarkozy, who paid a visit to Tripoli, together with European Commissioner responsible for external relations, Benito Ferro-Waldner, that this favourable outcome has become a fact. The Standard Daily, that's a pretty big and influential and popular daily in Bulgaria, mentioned French government blocking the anti-missile systems of Libya because they were French-made, just the way they did in Iraq.
Very interesting stuff from Radis Dingelev in Sofia there, mentioning one source talking about French coercion and threats to switch off Libya's anti-missile shield. Well, there's been fevered speculation in Brussels this week as to exactly how the deal to free the Bulgarian medics was made and who knew about it. In Network Europe's weekly trip to Brussels, Nina Maria Potts told me that before the champagne corks in Sofia had even started popping, difficult questions were being asked about the contents of the deal with Colonel Gaddafi's government.
Well, I think there's been an undercurrent of suspicion that's definitely cut through the whole EU-Libya deal from the beginning here in Brussels. I think amid all the euphoria, the question suddenly became, okay, a deal's been done, but what is the deal? What exactly has the EU promised away? You've got human rights organizations and other European leaders coming out and saying, hang on, we can't reward Libya by promising full ties, which is, you know, the umbrella phrase, of course, of the deal itself. And they're saying, did we all agree to this? And to which the answer is no, not yet. France and the European Commission have strongly denied that any money exchanged hands to get the medics freed. But, you know, then you have to ask what counts as money. There's the medical and humanitarian aid to Libyan hospitals, aid for education. We shouldn't forget also that the families of the victims were compensated in return for dropping the death sentence. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And where did that money come from? There was a fund distributed by the Gaddafi Foundation. The Libyans say money could come from certain European countries and charities. The European Commission is hotly denying any role in that deal. Allegedly, it paid 2.5 million euros into that fund. And of course, they're also refusing to name or say anything about which, you know, possibly companies or individuals or, you know, European countries put money in.
And what about Mr. Sarkozy's involvement? Because it does seem a bit of a coincidence that a couple of months after he's elected, with his boundless energy, he leaps into the frame here and suddenly we've got a deal.
Well, I think it's a very interesting dilemma for the European Commission in terms of what Sarkozy's role has actually been. And in a way, the EU couldn't have done it without him. Questions are being asked as to, you know, if we were so close to clinching a deal, how come it didn't happen earlier? Why did we need Sarkozy and his wife to step in? There's a certain, I think, a backlash in Brussels over the whole question of Mrs. Sarkozy and her sort of last-minute intervention, even though she says it was humanitarian, a resentment perhaps that she stole the limelight in the last few hours of clinching that deal. And as far as Nicolas Sarkozy's energy goes, I think questions are being asked about what France's motive is, and also a sense that Europe and national governments weren't consulted before this deal was struck. And we had a very strong statement from Belgium's foreign minister. He said that the Bulgarian medics were held in horrendous conditions for 8 years, that we mustn't reward Libya for their release. And, you know, when the Council of Ministers consulted about it, he, for one, would have very strong words to say about it. I think the difficulty for the Commission is that it's very much downplayed the role of Mrs. Sarkozy, but has expressed massive gratitude towards Nicolas Sarkozy. But in the very beginning, they weren't really saying very much about that intervention. Clearly now there's a bit of a dilemma because the European Commission wants to take credit for the deal that was offered and for the success of getting the medics released. But at the same time, it needs to show that Europe had a united front, presented a united front, and that people were on board. And we had Commission President José Manuel Barroso, as soon as the news broke that the medics had been released, personally thanking the Sarkozys for getting involved.
I want to send a special personal message to President Sarkozy and his wife, Madame Sarkozy, for their commitment and personal engagement. I am very grateful for this excellent cooperation with President Sarkozy and France. This shows the capacity to act in a united Europe. our attachment to justice, to the rule of law, to human rights, the force of a politics based on common and universal values.
Right, we'll leave that there. This isn't just a programme about Bulgaria and Nicolas Sarkozy. Of course, it's a special themed edition of Network Europe, and the theme is being abroad, Nina. And you've got some interesting statistics to give us on how the natives of Brussels are welcoming the great rainbow of foreigners who have sort of invaded. No, not invaded.
Well, I mean, I think that there's always going to be a certain degree of, you know, whinging in any expat community about how the local population treats foreigners. And of course, you know, I wouldn't want to generalise, but I think there are some interesting trends in Brussels. It's a very international city. It's home to the EU's institutions, to NATO. There's a relatively high percentage of foreigners living here. There's something like 25%, and the EU's expanded, so more people are pouring in. And I think there is a perception among locals that foreigners are working for the EU institutions, are very highly paid, that they're taking the best jobs, the best houses, pushing prices up. Foreigners on the whole, by and large, see Brussels as having a good standard of living, good for families, good medical care, cheap accommodation compared to London or New York or Paris. And many people talk about lacking contact with local Belgians. They complain that they live in an expat bubble. I spoke to one Moroccan mother who didn't want to be named, but she's lived in Belgium for about 28 years. She's raised her children here. She says she's worried for their future in Brussels.
Moroccans applying for work say, I have this or that diploma. And the employer on the end of the phone will say, OK, give us your name, we'll call you back or come in person. And when they do, they'll say, leave your name and number and we'll call you. But I don't think they ever do call back, and it's like that with nearly all the young Moroccans. But if it's a European who presents themselves, well, there you are.
It sounds like there are several strata to Belgian society now, because you have the French-speaking and the Dutch-speaking strata and the tensions between those. But also, you live in Brussels, you must have a sense of it being a city within a city, because when we refer to Brussels, we're not talking about the Belgian capital, we're talking about the capital of the EU, and it's not just any other expat community.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think it's definitely a two-tiered city, and very often it's very easy to get sucked into being completely focused on the EU institutions and, you know, the sense of cosmopolitanism that goes along with Brussels. And, you know, many Belgians will admit freely that life has improved, that it has become a more cosmopolitan city. What they complain about is that rents have become, you know, unaffordable, and they resent foreigners for pushing those prices up.
Next time you get sick, would you mind terribly if I sent you to recuperate in a Spanish health spa, all expenses paid? Well, as if Scandinavia wasn't utopian enough already, Norway does exactly this if your condition requires it. The Norwegian public health system now sends the sick, elderly and disabled on holidays to Spain as part of their medical treatment. Thousands of Norwegians are visiting rehabilitation centres run by Norwegian health associations along Spain's Mediterranean coast. Deutsche Welle's Danny Wood visited the Ruma Sol Rehabilitation Centre near Benidorm for Network Europe. He wasn't sick, though, so we couldn't get Norway to pay for him.
Please don't be waiting for me!
A morning exercise routine at an exclusive Spanish resort for Norwegians. Alongside this swimming pool nestle elegant holiday apartments set in landscaped gardens with a children's playground and a mini golf course. But this is more than just a vacation.
Because of the spasm, you have to work extremely hard.
Tears coming.
Guy Eriksson suffers from a disorder called hereditary spastic paraparesis, which has left him wheelchair-bound with very swollen legs. His doctor has prescribed a holiday in Spain at the Norwegian-run Ruma Sol Rehabilitation Centre near Benidorm in Alicante as part of his free treatment.
I can go to my doctor and say I need a trip to, for example, Spain, and it's okay.
Really? The doctor says, yes, that's definitely a good thing for your health. Off you go. Signs the papers.
Yes, that's right. It's a very good thing from the government.
What's the difference between staying in Norway and getting treatment and coming here?
In Norway, it's a very cold, and here in Spain we have 30 degrees and hot weather.
For conditions like Guy's, and for thousands of elderly people whose muscles and joints are swollen with arthritis, a program of physiotherapy in warm conditions makes a lot of difference. Berit Cheve, the head nurse, says the health benefits of hot weather are only part of this Norwegian treatment philosophy.
You have got treatment from the physiotherapist every day, and you have got social activity as well, and that they can make friends with others, that they can continue their friendship at home, which it's not very easy in Norway when it's cold outside. You don't go outside your house. And you can think about yourself. You don't have to think about your problems at home. You can just leave them at the airport in Norway, I think.
To explain one of her favourite treatments, Evie Madsen, the head physiotherapist, shows me a room full of walking sticks.
This is Nordic walking. It's like going skiing without skis. We have very good results with these. And it makes you move your arms a lot more, and it has an influence on the heart and the lung system. We have groups of this 2 times a week, where we go walking with the patients around in the area, and we explain to them a little bit of the history of the center and so on. Yeah, we try to give them just a complete package, not only giving them a good physical treatment, but also, you know, making them feel well in any kind of way.
One of the most enthusiastic people receiving treatment here is 16-year-old Tamarin Varner, who suffers from cerebral palsy.
It's a very nice place for handicapped people to feel who they are and can be who they are.
So have you made many friends here?
Yes, I've made 7 friends, actually. I have met many people here and many good friends for life.
This very social, positive holiday atmosphere with the comforts of a luxury resort and quality daily medical care is cost-effective for Norway's public health system, according to the manager, Harald Halvorsen.
Well, it was not cheap to build this and it's not cheap to run it, but Norway is a very expensive country, so they can actually save money by sending them here. We have lower running costs than you will have in Norway.
And it's not just the patients who are very happy. So are the Norwegian staff, like Evie Madsen, head physiotherapist.
I'm thinking that people are saving up money to come to Spain for a week and a year, and here I am living here. It's like really living in a dream. I'm just thrilled being here.
For Europeans from colder climates, this could be the perfect medical prescription. Publicly funded treatment in Spanish sunshine. Danny Wood, Alicante.
I'm sure that policy would go down well in Britain, but until somebody there thinks of it, my compatriots seem content to self-medicate. And for large numbers of men on stag weekends, that means picking up a cheap flight to Krakow in Poland. The beer's cheap, the hotels are cheap, and until recently at least, the local population greeted them warmly. To give the uninitiated an idea of what the British stag weekend is, groups of up to 20 men or so, usually friends and relatives of the one getting married, go away for the weekend to celebrate the groom's last days of bachelor life. They often wear matching T-shirts with nicknames printed on the backs. Dano, Bobbo, Billy the Fish, things like that. Such weekends often get so beer-soaked that in Prague, another popular cheap booze destination, the British Embassy plans to issue 20,000 beer mats warning that under Czech law, you could spend a couple of days in jail for being drunk and disorderly. John Beecham reports for Network Europe from Krakow on the British lads who bring their culture with them.
Krakow is one of Poland's busiest tourist destinations. With the opening up of the job markets in some EU countries, many Poles have decided to pack up their bags in search of better salaries in harder currencies. The gap that has been left behind is still to be filled, but Krakow, like many other Polish cities, is prospering, especially in the tourist sector. The influx of tourists to the cultural capital of Poland has been spurred on by cheap airlines flying from major hubs across Europe. Yet not all visitors coming to Krakow have culture in mind. Well, not high culture. It is not very hard to determine who is a resident and who is a tourist visiting the city. Yet there are some nationalities that stand out more than others. Mada is a student from Krakow and told me how to discern who is who and what they have come to Krakow for.
When you walk down the street in Krakow, you can meet a lot of different people right now. You can somehow recognize them by the first of all, behavior, and then secondly, their style. What is the most remarkable? It's, for example, within the British people. They come here to Krakow because basically they want to have fun.
Bronek has been a barman in Krakow for a long time now, and he divides tourists into different groups.
These groups are divided for the age and nationality. So we've got young people and elder people, and generally elder people come here to Krakow to see our, the most beautiful things here in Krakow. I mean, Wawel Castle, Wieliczka Salt Mine, or any other beautiful monuments, museums, and they just come here to have a great time for themselves, generally couples in the age of 50 or 60 years old. They are calm, they are really nice people, and there is a group of young people, guys from Great Britain. They come here for the stag parties. They are young, and Krakow is cheap enough for them to have here weekend, including everything. I mean, having a great time in our pubs, in our hotels.
How do foreigners themselves view the behavior of their fellow countrymen in Krakow? I caught up with Pat, an IT teacher from Galway in Ireland.
Unfortunately, I have met people from England and also people from Ireland. Their behavior is not very nice. I'm embarrassed by the fact when I see Irish people doing things that they're doing. Just being rowdy, noisy, and I don't like that. And any of the English people I have seen, well, sorry, the ones I've heard, is because they are loud. They are not an attraction to this beautiful city.
I met members of stag parties on a night out in Krakow Top Spots, having it large in the vernacular of the visitors. None of the interviews could be used in this report, but scenes of games and rowdy behaviour have become commonplace in the bars of the old town. Mother, once again.
It was like hilarious scene that I saw once. I was in a bar outside, and there was a group of British guys celebrating the year. Like stock party or something. They played a game that I didn't know, obviously. And they didn't care about the people around them. They were shouting. The whole idea of the game was that they were hiding themselves under the tables.
Bad-mannered Brits have been causing a stir in Krakow for over a year now. Magazines, newspapers, and the local media have been diverting residents' attention to the plague of stags that swarm through the city every weekend, often with dramatic consequences. The press has only managed to identify the problem, though, and has failed to come up with a solution. After all, Krakow is making a lot of money from tourists that come here, and while some bars are raking in thousands of zlotys a day, the price that residents are having to pay is becoming too high. Perhaps simple measures like teaching the local police force to speak English would help. Then at least other tourists who visit Krakow might feel safer. For now, though, Krakow has to bear the brunt of uneducated, raucous and unruly groups of foreigners. Well, only Brits and Irishmen for the foreseeable future. I'm John Beecham in Krakow.
That's not a happy John Beecham in Krakow, is it? But enough about Brits drinking European destinations into a stupor. Legend has it the Swedes can give the Brits a run for their beer money. When they travel, many Swedes make use of the country's charter travel industry. It's one of the few ways to swap the rain and snow for a bit of sun. Add to that Sweden's restrictive laws on alcohol and you're left with the motivation for many Swedes to see holidays as opportunities for liquor-fueled benders. Swedish Radio's George Wood asked Lisa Lenneman from Sweden's largest tour operator, Vingresor, whether the Swedes really do have a Viking capacity for knocking back the holiday booze.
Swedish people are good drinkers, but we're not better or worse than any other nationality, I think, while we go on holiday. Our clients, they don't go abroad to get drunk. They want to go there to relax, spend time with their family and just have a good time.
How do you think the people abroad who meet the Swedes who arrive there, not the ones in the tourist industry, but the ordinary people who live there, how do you think they perceive Swedes? How are Swedes seen in other countries?
Actually, from our experience, Swedes, they have quite good reputation. We're not that loud. We stand in line. We're quite respectful. And, you know, compared to other nationalities, we're quite easy to deal with, I think. Or that's the impression I get when I talk to our staff abroad. The only negative thing I've ever actually heard is that Swedish people can be seen as quite cheap because we don't tip. We don't have that culture here, like Americans, for example.
Lisa Linneman, head of information for Vingresor. And I'm now in their shop, and I'm going to talk to some travelers about their plans and what they think about traveling abroad. Where are you planning to travel to?
To Las Vegas.
And why?
We go into Las Vegas because we are on vacation, of course, and taking a car to drive up the coast to Los Angeles and then to San Francisco, and from there to back home.
You make a lot of travel by Swedish charter?
Actually, yes, at least once a year.
How do you think Swedes are seen by people in other countries?
Reserved, good-looking, nice when you get to know them.
What about drinking? I think there's a feeling here that Swedes get abroad and just go on binges.
You mean just party? Younger people maybe, yes. Especially when they go to south of Europe, to Greece and countries like that. Yeah, that's maybe true, yeah.
I think the jury's out on who tops the tipple table. Now, leaving the subject of drinking behind for the rest of the programme, prepare for there to be no connection at all. Like me, you've no doubt often wondered what Serbs do when they go to Paris for the weekend. For Network Europe, Anastup Roy discovers that, like the Brits, they come in search of their own culture. It just involves being more sober.
When Serbians come to Paris, just like all other tourists, they go to Montmartre, they go up the Eiffel Tower, and then they also go to see the Mona Lisa in the Louvre Museum. Or sometimes they even go to the Moulin Rouge for a spicy evening. But those are not the only places where the Serbian tourists in Paris go. When they visit the Eiffel Tower, for example, they also like to walk for a few minutes in the Rue Belgrade, or Belgrade Street, which is named after the Serbian capital city. And not far from Radio France International's office in Paris, they love to get themselves photographed right in front of the statue of the Serbian king, Peter I. It indeed is a very huge statue, one of the biggest in Paris. One avenue in Paris also carries his name, Avenue Pierre le Premier, in the chic 16th district of the French capital. It is in this avenue that Paris has its Museum of Fashion and Style. I asked Mikhailo Papazoglu, a Serbian diplomat, about what the reason was behind this link between Paris and Belgrade.
Peter I. Well, he served, but he started his military career in Saint-Cyr. And as a young lieutenant, he fought under the French command during the French-Prussian War in 1870. And he was honored for bravery. So when he became a king, of course, the relations between Serbia and France became much tighter. So we could say that the love story begins with him, I would say so. And the most flourished period was during in between the two world wars.
The relations were so good that in 1920, Belgrade received the Légion d'honneur, France's highest annual civilian award. And the Serbian capital is just one of the rare cities to have got the award that is generally conferred to human mortals. Most Serbian tourists who come to Paris know a lot about the relations between the two capitals. And because they love the French capital so much, they come back sometimes again and again and again, like Nevim, who is from Belgrade. I meet Nevim as he takes the metro from Vienna, just near the Peter I Avenue, to go to the Serbian church a few stations later. Among several things that he knows about the Franco-Serbian love affair, he says he also knows that the Paris metro was partly financed by the King of Serbia.
After all, France was destroyed by the war, and Serbia had quite full chests which were invested into development, among the other things, of metro in Paris.
Paris is Nevim's favorite city, but that is when he's not in Belgrade. And so he says in Serbian,
Svuda pođi kući dođi. That means go wherever you want, but always come back home.
Most Serbians do try out the French delicacies, but when they start feeling a bit homesick, they like to go to some Serbian restaurants for some homemade food. But even there, they can sometimes eat some foie gras or drink some champagne. The Franco-Serbian friendship is the theme of a song from the First World War, when the French Navy rescued Serbian soldiers from Thessaloniki in Greece. The song says, "The French ships are going away far into the horizon with our wounded soldiers in the ships. The French are taking care of them." And Nevim's friend Emir knows this song by heart.
Kreće se lađa francuska, sa pristaništa solunska.
Ending this report with a song sung by Emir from Serbia. For Network Europe, I'm Anastup Roy.
Транспорт се крече робови. Робови брача.
Right, we're almost out of time, but there are a couple of minutes left for this week's postcard. And this week, Paddy Maguire from Radio Netherlands Worldwide bails out his sister, quite literally.
In England, we love to talk about the weather. We're all talking about the weather now, in biblical proportions. And so it was that I travelled back to London for a week's holiday to catch up with friends and family. As I kicked back in my sister's new flat one evening, we discussed her plans for her own birthday party in a couple of days, and her holiday in Thailand a few days after that. If it was sunny, people could be in the garden. If it rained, they could be inside. The usual weathery chit-chat. And as we chatted, her somewhat doom-laden neighbour poked her head over the fence, peered into the front room of the flat and started talking about floods. Best to be careful, she said. There's been flooding on this road before, and there are rains ahead. My sister and I looked at each other and rolled our eyeballs. Later in the evening, I told my sister she should get some sandbags. She chuckled, but an edge of concern crept into her laughter as it trailed off. Well, at least I'm insured now, she said, so if the worst does happen, I'll be covered. True, I said. Anyway, it's good to be able to hang out with you for a while, and here as well, just when you've got it all sorted. Really, it looks great. The next day, I said goodbye and headed to Oxford. And then the rain started, and carried on, and carried on. You've probably seen the pictures on the news. Vast swathes of Middle England hidden under water. Thousands and thousands of homes flooded, destroyed, and not an ark in sight. The traffic heading back into London a day later was terrible. I rang my sister to say I'd drop in as I made my way across town. She was walking back to her flat as we spoke. It's raining here too, she said. Really heavy. In fact, I'm just at my front gate and I can see the cat scrabbling at the window. Listen, I'm going to have to call you back. It was bad, very bad. The next days, or holidays as they should have been, were spent emptying and cleaning a brand new apartment of everything inside it. A lifetime of papers and documents, photos, paintings, furniture. Black, stinking crud had permeated everything. Everything was ruined. And I emphasised the thing to ensure we keep perspective. The birthday was cancelled, but she did make it to Thailand. That's us Brits. We just love to talk about the weather.
I hate talking about the weather, but I do it anyway. Just enough time for this month's quiz winner. Thanks for all of your entries, but the idea I liked most for how the EU should improve its image came from Behzad Payende in Tehran in Iran, who says EU leaders should work for the people who voted for them. If they don't support EU people properly, you suffer hunger and strikes, homelessness and depravity. Crime and unrest erupt, and very soon the people who voted the politicians in erode the very basis of the union. Not so much an idea for improving their image as a suggestion to get on with doing the job properly. Less spin, more work, I suppose. But a nice suggestion all the same, Bejad. Well, that's all we have time for. Network Europe will be back next week from Bonn in Germany. If you have time to drop us a line and let us know what you think of the programme, we'd love to hear from you. Please write to contact@networkeurope.org. From me, Richard Walker, here in Hilversum in Holland, thanks for listening. Network Europe is a partnership of Radio Netherlands Worldwide, Radio France International, Deutsche Welle, Radio Sweden, Radio Slovenia, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Bulgaria, Polish Radio External Services, and Radio Romania International. I don't wanna-